And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the rousing opening number to the musical Legally Blonde. And Legally Blonde is opening this weekend at Carthage College. And on most of today's morning show, we're going to be celebrating this high-spirited musical that is so much fun, but also carries a really powerful message at its heart. And with us in the studios today is, first of all, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Matt Hoagland, who is the director of musical theater at Carthage. And he has three students with him who are all in the cast of Legally Blonde. And we have Alexan Cervantes, who is a sophomore elementary education major, who plays the role of Ellie Woods. That's the role made famous by Reese Witherspoon in the film from like 20 years ago or so.
Yeah, 2001.
Yeah. Also with us, Caitlin Preuss, who is a senior music theater and direction major, who plays the role of Vivienne, and Nikki Caldwell, a senior music theater major, who is in the role of Emmett. So all three of them in the cast for Legally Blonde. And in the midst of what I know is a really, really, really busy week, we appreciate you getting up bright and early to be here on the morning show. We welcome all of you here.
Thanks for having us.
So first of all, Matt, take us inside the decision to do Legally Blonde. I don't even before we get to that, just talk a little bit about how the whole year gets put together at Carthage in terms of musical theater and all the different opportunities that you want to offer students. How does the whole year overall get put together?
Sure. Well, it's a process of collaboration 101 between myself and the theater department to talk about what we want to be able to offer to our students, and also what students we have that we either need to highlight or need to have senior theses that they need to complete. And that's not just actors, but maybe you've got student designers who need to complete their theses process by the time they're seniors. So for example, we have student costume designer who is completing their thesis. We've got a student lighting designer who's completing their thesis on this. So we needed a show that had a lot of elements that could then fulfill all of those requirements. So on top of that, I just love musicals that are fun and that I want to see. So it's completely my agenda. Wrong. But we also knew that we had the right crop of humans this year in order to do Legally Blonde. So it's a show of 23 humans. And when I pitched it to the theater department, they were all pretty much on board right away. It was pretty good. Everyone's like, okay, if you think this is the right thing, then like, let's do it. So we do. We talk about an entire season at one point, and to make sure that we're sort of covering bases for not only student needs, but also who we have as majors, also non-majors, talking about Lexi being here as a non-major. So who are these people that we can supply this opportunity to? So for example, when we looked at for next season, we're now doing two musicals with the theater department. So we're starting in the fall with Carrie, the musical, and then we'll finish in the spring next year with Nine, the musical, the Moore Yeston, which is gorgeous. So I'm really excited about that. That will then also highlight next year's crop of humans, while these seniors to my right over here will be graduating and living their lives out in the real world. So yeah, it's a full collaboration between myself and the theater department and who we've got on tap.
Excellent. One of the things that was mentioned in the Kenosha News article about Legally Blonde, which people should seek out if they haven't seen that yet, it's a wonderful article by Liz Snyder, is that you happen to personally know the people responsible for creating this musical in the first place. Tell us about your connection with them.
Yeah, so Larry and Nell, Larry O'Keefe and Nell Benjamin. So I worked with them when I was at NYU doing my grad work, and they came in and put on one of their shows, which is called Life of the Party, and it's still in workshop phases. And they put that on us as humans at NYU, and so I was able to work with them really intimately during my last semester of grad school, and then I went on and did a couple workshops and readings for them afterwards, and have also visited Larry's mother lives in a sort of retirement community up in upstate New York, and he would take a couple of us who had done things for him before, and we would go and like sing for Mother's Day and sing for like Father's Day. Like, we would just go and do a bunch of fun events, which was really great. And then Nell has, of course, gone on, and she wrote the lyrics to Mean Girls, the musical. So she's gone on to continue that. Of course, they're still creating musicals together. Larry also wrote Bat Boy, if you're familiar with that musical. And so they've continued on to keep writing, but and they do a lot of actually like jingle work. And so my voice is somewhere on some jingle in some country. I don't know where. But yeah, so I have a lovely personal relationship with them, and really excited that I could bring their musical here to Carthage.
Wonderful. I just saw Mean Girls, Kenosha Unified, just mounted a spectacular production of that. And I had a niece that was in the cast and a couple of voice students, so I made a point of going, and I was just blown away by what a great, great show that is.
And it's fun.
Excited to see Legally Blonde as well. And we have three students with us as well, as I introduced a little earlier. Another thing mentioned in the Kenosha News article is Matt describes the scene when this announcement was made that this was going to be the main stage musical this year. So I wonder, I assume at least a couple of you were there. Describe it in your own words, what it was like when this announcement was made, just the level of excitement and why there was so much excitement.
I was pumped out of my mind. This is Caitlin. I was really excited when it was announced. This is definitely a fan favorite for especially like our generation of MT kids, just because it's like super contemporary. It's super fun. It's like really, it's challenging to sing, and that like always poses interest to like kind of conquer that goal. And like also it has a ton of fantastic female roles in it. So especially being a department that is really female heavy, I think personally I was like, oh yes, like as you said, like this is the time. Like we're gonna kill this. We have the people for this. It's gonna be just like a fantastically fun time, and it really has been that. Like just singing this music every day is fun and uplifting, and you know, we've been doing a lot of really fun shows around Carthage recently, and being able to like keep that up, and especially like this being my last one, was like more than appropriate.
Mm, very good. Nikki, were you there as well when this big announcement was made?
And yes.
Describe the scene.
So we're sitting in our theater forum, and the slide comes up, and they played the same song that you played. Oh my God, you guys. And we all, of course, know the song. So there's a cheer that just erupts from the crowd as we all start singing along with the song that we haven't yet learned, but we all know.
And all the graduating seniors were like, okay, awesome.
Crushed.
They were like, have fun, you guys.
Oh, that's right. This is something that they were going to miss out on, as audience members, I suppose. Now, Alexan Cervantes, who plays Ellie, you're not a music theater major, nor a music major, so I assume you weren't in this room when this big announcement was made.
No, I was not. My friends, Ellie and Tiffany, actually told me about it, and I was so excited. Like, I have been telling my parents for years that I would just love to be in the show, period, as, like, anybody in the cast. But, like, Elle has been a dream role of mine for years, since I was, like, 14. And when the audition notice came out, I was like, okay, I'm going to audition for Elle. So
there you go. And here it all worked out. Yeah. So Matt, tell us a little bit about this kind of interesting scenario of obviously having all of these really gifted and skilled music theater majors and yet not wanting to limit this or probably a lot of projects to just people who are majoring in this.
Yeah. I think I mean, that goes to the core to me of a liberal arts education, right? We're here to provide opportunities to all students. And that's also the same in the real world. They're not going to look and see where your BFA or your BM or whatever came from. They don't care. They care about who you are in the room and in the audition process. And so we, as the theater department and music department, all believe that it is everyone is welcome. Everyone can come and audition, and may the best person get it. Little Game of Thrones-ish there. But, like, you know, come on in and, like, do it and prove it, and then we'll be able to take it from there. So we had several candidates. I will admit I had no idea who was going to play the title role when I picked the show. I knew sort of how I could possibly cast things depending on how people showed up, but I knew at some point Elle would just show up, and then I'd look at Martin and go, well, that was it. And I haven't even told you this, but Lexi came in and auditioned, and you know, in their first initial appointments, it's just they did, I think, maybe 16 or 32 bars of a song from Legally Blonde, and she came in, she left the room, and I remember turning to Martin and go, well, I think we found her. And then, like, the callbacks are then just proving that we were right. Mm. So it was great. And I love that Lexi is not a major and also in the title role. And we have several other students who are not musical theater or even theater majors or minors who are in this production. And I think that's a super important part of, again, liberal arts education, but also the opportunities that you can just have as a human that make you a much better person in the workplace, in your daily life. You learn so many skills in musical theater, time management and having to be where you are and do a thing the same way 8 times in a row a week.
Be part of a team.
Oh my gosh, collaboration 101. How do you work with your peers? How do you not work with your peers,
maybe? How do you take criticism?
Oh, how do you take notes when your director's mad at you at 10 o'clock at night, you know? I'm never mad. No. But, you know, you just learn life skills, which I love. And that's, yeah, I think that's just pivotal.
It also seems like there's at least something of a parallel to the central theme of Legally Blonde, also about, you know, unexpected opportunities that mm-hmm. come your way and making the most of them and so yeah. on, and blooming wherever you happen to be planted and so on. And
well, Elle even has a great line about not judging a book by its cover, sort of, but then also talking about how, you know, how you present yourself is how the world is going to see you, but also how you want to present your best self, but also don't judge what you see. You know, I think the whole big joke of Legally Blonde is that blondes have a bad rap, right? And I think we're in 2023 and we're really past that at this point. But, you know, this whole movie and this musical was built on the trope that blondes are dumb and blondes can't get into Harvard, you know? And I think this is a great opportunity for us to tell the opposite of that story. And right. I don't think it's just about blondes, right? I think it's also about female presenting women who, you know, have so many things that they have to go up against, and Elle just breaks all of those barriers.
Right, mm-hmm. just blasts them to smithereens.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about Carthage College's production of the musical Legally Blonde, which opens this weekend and runs the following weekend as well. We have Matt Hoagland with us, who is the music director of this production. Martin McClendon, who's been on the program before, is the stage director for this production. And we have 3 members of the cast, Alexan Cervantes, Caitlin Preuss, and Nikki Caldwell. We've touched briefly on the movie. I can't believe it's been more than 20 years that mm-hmm. movie came out. I remember the one only time I've watched it was on a Carthage Choir tour. They put that videotape on the VCR on the bus, mm-hmm. and so we watched Legally Blonde on our way back from wherever we'd been. But anyway, so I fondly remember it. So for people, we'll describe more of the plot in a moment, but how closely does the musical adhere to that original film?
Pretty close. You've got some good key lines. Your, like, one-liners that you want from the movie are definitely in the show. They do change a couple things. The professor in the movie is a woman, but in the show it's a male-presenting character. And then, other than that, I think it's pretty close. Vivian's character is probably the most changed from the movie to the musical.
Yeah.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I play Vivian, who is arguably an antagonist for most of the story, and then, like, she really turns it around at the last second there. And in the movie, I think that they just develop her character differently. They kind of develop Elle and Vivian's relationship a little bit more in the movie. Mm. And then in the musical, like, Vivian is a very, like, standalone, she makes all the choices completely on her own. And she kind of, like, wakes up one day and realizes how much she was judging a book by its cover and, like, how terrible she'd been to somebody who just wanted to be good at something. I love the character arc of Vivian, especially. Just, like, a woman who holds herself accountable and grows and learns. And it really does come out of nowhere. I mean, she shows up and she's like, actually, I love you. And it's really fun. So
very cool. So all of you had this strong acquaintance with, it sounds like, both the movie and the musical, although in some cases the movie came out before you were born or while you were still in diapers, I'm guessing.
I was about 3 weeks old when it came out.
Wow. So, I mean, is your entry to this the movie or more the musical? I mean, where was your initial enthusiasm springing from, the movie or the musical or both?
Nikki? Definitely the musical for me. I have to confess that I have not seen the movie.
Oh. Wow, good for you.
And was that a conscious decision?
It is not. I was born after the movie came out. And
you got to watch that.
Yeah, I know. I've been told a couple times in the last couple days. So it's I'm going to see it just for you, Caitlin.
Okay, thank you.
Wait until after the production, please.
Okay.
Yeah,
there you go. How about you, Alexa?
I've always been a fan of the movie. It's been one of my comfort movies, you could say, for a few years, and it's always just been like a fun movie to watch, just to like, yeah.
So then did you know the musical, and if so, how?
Yeah, I did. I watched like the Search for Elle Woods MTV show, and I was like hooked on it after that.
And what is that?
It's
great.
It's basically, it was a competition show on MTV in like 2008,
or so, yeah.
I want to say. And it was basically a bunch of girls who were auditioning for the Broadway production of Legally Blonde, since the main, like Laura Bell Bundy, was leaving. And it was basically just them going like week after week, like cutting girls and seeing who was like the best fit for Elle Woods.
I love that reality show, because it was sort of the first time that America had a view into the not only Broadway but like sort of the casting process in a really that affected this generation, I think. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in my generation we had documentaries about, you know, I think about like One Tiny Step about Chorus Line.
Yeah.
That like my generation sort of knew, and we saw the casting process that way. But this was like on MTV. It came in like after The Real World, you know, during the height of like reality and not scripted reality yet. And so I loved that because it sort of showed what was happening. And then they did a really fun version of, they filmed the musical and then did sort of like a sing along with it. So like they would have the lyrics. I'm really dating myself because I watched this on TV in time.
I mean, I've watched it on YouTube at least 5 times.
Yeah, exactly. But they had the lyrics on the screen, and then like there's a dog in it, Bruiser, and the Chihuahua literally bounced across the screen for the lyrics. So you could literally sing along with Elle. So of course, myself as a budding music theater person, whenever this came out, I was like screaming at the top of my lungs and loved it. So the fact that, you know, I loved it in my generation, and I know that like they can still watch it on YouTube now, like it's just so fun. I think it's multi-generational in that
right
way.
So for a lot of people, and maybe for you guys, that this is your entry to the musical, was the way you came to know the musical so well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is my second time in the show, actually. So it's always been, it's been like a little nostalgic. This was like one of my like youth, you know, productions that I did. So it's been the musical all the way, for sure.
We have a couple. I think we have four of you all together who have done it before, but they've all done different roles.
Yeah.
So that's what I love. You know, you can like be, because who were you?
I was one of the Dalton. I was Pilar.
Okay. Right. And then now to be Vivian.
Yeah,
right?
Just like, totally different.
Wow. You've grown up.
I have. Cool. I have.
So, Caitlin, since you have such a deep acquaintance, why don't we have you summarize, even beyond what we've done already.
I'd love to.
Summarize the essential story of
Totally.
Legally Blonde.
Totally. So we open in Malibu and we kind of, we see originally the Delta Nu sorority house, which is this big, pink, fantastically fun time. And everybody is so excited because Elle's getting engaged today. That's like the main song. Oh my God, you guys, it's about Elle getting engaged. So we're freaking out and we're so pumped. And then, as we continue through the story, Elle goes to dinner with her boyfriend Warner, and you really think she's gonna get engaged. And then, he dumps her in the middle of dinner. And that's kind of where, you know, like our turning point kicks in. So from there on out, Elle has this big realization that, perhaps what would make Warner fall in love with her is if she were more serious and if she went to Harvard and followed him at Harvard Law School, to show him that like she was really worthy of his love. So she studies and passes her LSATs within a matter of maybe like 3 weeks. So you think it's really fast. And then, yeah, she convinces Harvard that she's going to get in, and she shows up and pretty much everybody hates her, except for Emmett. she meets Emmett, and he's a really like helpful guide and friend to her. And as you kind of continue through the story, she's met with like a lot of enemies. Warner is now engaged, or first dating, they get engaged later, to Vivian, who's like this, the opposite of Elle in every way. Like, she's very stuck up, she's a brunette, all of those things. And so she kind of chooses Elle to hunker down, and she's like, you know what, I'm not gonna let any of these people get in my way, and I'm actually going to get good at this. So with the help of Emmett, and then she meets a friend, Paulette, at the local hair salon, they all kind of band together, and she becomes actually really good and really knowledgeable at law. And then in the second act, the whole law team tackles a really big profile case with exercise queen Brooke Wyndham, whose husband has recently been killed. And so she's on trial, and Elle pretty much does the whole thing herself. I mean, she like keeps finding evidence, and she keeps like bringing them closer and closer to winning this case. And then a big turning point in the second act is when Elle's professor hits on her and fires her because she does not take his advances because she's a strong woman. And so she heads out. She's like, I gotta go. Check you later. I'm done. And who of all people should show up to bring her back but Vivian? So then we come back. And and yeah, I'm not going to spoil if we win the case.
Don't spoil the ending.
Yeah. But then everybody has a really good time at the end. Everyone's really happy.
It's a big old party.
And you graduate at Harvard.
Cool.
Get to attend a Harvard graduation. Yeah.
Cool. Alexa, let's hear more about your character of Elle and this surprisingly successful time she has at Harvard Law School. First of all, the way this plays out in the musical, does that make sense? Is that at all plausible? I mean, it would seem on the surface not to be, but does it ultimately make sense for her to achieve this incredible success that nobody would have predicted she could achieve?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. In the show, it says that she has a 4.0 GPA and that she's applying to Harvard. She gets like a near perfect score on her LSATs, and she has like a letter of recommendation from like Oprah. And so like all of those things put together, I think, help her to get into Harvard. And then once she's there, she doesn't really do like her homework a whole lot. But then once Emmett helps her out and sort of guides her through the classes and through her homework, then she gets a lot better at law and like knowing what to say in class and everything. And then in like towards the end of Act One, she is in class with Warner and Callahan, and she is basically like, hey, this isn't how this case is supposed to go. It was the like anonymous sperm donor case, and she's just like, no, he can't really be the father because he didn't track every sexual encounter that he had.
Yeah, well, and that's her, the ding, ding, ding moment.
Yeah, that's her. That's her moment of like, oh, I can speak legalese.
Yes.
And like sort of think that way as a lawyer. And I think that's like the pivotal moment for mm-hmm. her when she's able to like prove that in that classroom. Mm-hmm.
And then later, once her and Paulette are going to see like her ex-husband, she realizes that she is actually really good at this and that she's really passionate about law.
Right.
Are there ways in which who she was plays into why she succeeds? I mean, or is it just that she was a lot smarter than even she knew? Is it just about being smarter than you realize you are? Or are there ways in which who she is and what she has valued serves her well in this newer arena?
Yeah, I would definitely say both of those are factors into like how Elle is when she's in a law setting. And since she has like a really bubbly personality, she is really personable and she likes to talk to people. And especially like when they're in the Brooke Wyndham case, she realizes that Brooke is also a Delta Nu, like Elle is, and then they bond over that, and she really gains Brooke's trust over that, which ultimately helps her, like, so much in the end. So.
Very good. So one of the people who really makes a difference for her is Emmett, who's already at law school and a TA there. So mm-hmm. tell us more about his character, and if right from the start, is he friendly and helpful to Elle, or does that only happen gradually over time, and why? I mean, why is he so helpful to her?
Yeah, so I think he's really helpful very from the start because he views her as a person. I think a lot of the other law students see a blonde showing up to Harvard and they think, oh, she's just a pretty face. She's not, you know, smart enough to do this, or she's not a real person. But Emmett, he sees her as a human being with, you know, human qualities, and he realizes that she has what it takes to do this, and so he really pushes her. He sees that she can do it, but that she's almost choosing not to at first. Mm. She's very focused on other things, and so he pushes her pretty hard in the first act to focus on the law of it all and to apply herself, honestly, and he was right. She is completely capable of doing this and being successful and being great at it. Yeah.
She also helps him.
Oh, absolutely.
In the end, which I love, right? It's not just like, you know, a man comes in and saves a woman. It's not that at all, right? It's actually they save each other in this really cool way. You know, I would say that Emmett is a little maybe frumpy, maybe not exactly really smart, but not street smart.
Absolutely. And, Emmett, right? Emmett, he's very discerning, but he grew up in a very poor sort of household situation. Mm. He had lots of bad male influences, and he grew up with his mostly single mother. So I think that's one of the reasons why he sort of can understand the humanity of people that a lot of other people sort of would look down to. But then he also doesn't understand how to stand up to men in his life. So, for example, the professor, he, I think, is very afraid to stand up to this professor because the professor's in a position of authority, and Emmett, I think, is afraid of people who are in authority, and especially men in figures of power. And Elle shows him that that you can, you know, stand up for yourself. Mm-hmm.
And he gets a makeover in Act 2. Yes. Who doesn't love a makeover sequence, you know?
he earned it. Yeah, he earned his makeover.
He did earn it.
Well, speaking of makeovers, as we were saying earlier, the role of Vivian is kind of the antagonist, kind of a villainess in at least some respects, and it sounds like for a fair amount of the show, that's the role that they play. And I'm thinking also of the role of Warner. What's his full name again?
Huntington III.
Warner Huntington III. He's played by a voice student of mine, John Rasmussen. So
Hey, John.
How are villains and villainesses treated in this show? And for instance, is that character, do we get to see some positive side of him eventually, like we eventually do with Vivian?
I think that Warner and Vivian are a little bit different just because Vivian, Warner's just kind of stupid, in my opinion. He's just not really all there. He's kind of like, my family says I need to go to law school, so I go. And that's pretty much as far as it goes.
Vivian, no passion for it the way.
No. And that's kind of, I mean, when you talk about Warner's journey, though, it's not nearly as like, it's not triumphant, I wouldn't say, but he figures out like where he's actually supposed to be, and it's not law school, which is also like a wonderful thing about the story, because Elle's like, no, I belong here, and you actually don't. Mm-hmm. So that's always a fun replacement moment. I think Vivian is a little bit different from Warner in that I think that Vivian has had a really hard time with women her whole life, and women like seemingly on the outside what Elle is. Who can waltz in somewhere and get something because of how they look, or like who feel as though that is number one. And for Vivian, she has worked hard and she is very smart, and that has always been number one. And so she immediately, without even speaking a word to Elle, is like, no, I hate you because I think this is what you are. And it doesn't help that she's Warner's ex-girlfriend, and Vivian's like, well, I'm gonna marry Warner, mostly for his money, but I'm gonna do it, and his status. I do think that both of the characters definitely, I think that every character in the show, the really lovely thing about the show is that at the end it is one of the most satisfying endings ever, because everybody is exactly where they're supposed to be. And that's like just always a really joyful thing to see. I mean, that's like the epitome of a happy ending. So
right. And yet it feels real. It feels authentic from the sounds of it. I mean, because there are a lot of They Lived Happily Ever After shows that where that just feels like something kind of pasted on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like that's what this is. This seems like it's an organic happy ending.
No, because you don't expect some of it. I mean, you don't. If you've never ever seen Legally Blonde before and you walk in and like, you know, you meet Elle Woods in the first number, you do not expect that the last scene is going to be her Harvard graduation. Like, you really don't. Yeah. And it's the same with where a lot of the characters land. And I think that's like a really fun thing at the end there when you get to do literally like Paulette goes through like what happened to everyone. Like, you know, at the end of the movie, they do the same thing. So it's really familiar and lovely.
Yeah. Super.
They do a great job of wrapping it up in a way that like the villain gets their due in that way, and but it's not like grotesque and gruesome, and they don't take so long to think about it. It's like a sentence and you go, oh cool, I can like wrap that up in my brain and then like live in the happiness that you're in, which is nice.
Super. Matt, tell us a little bit about, and then the students are welcome to chime in, but about the physical production and the fact that you have some student designers who have been hard at work to give this show its distinctive look.
Yeah. We also brought in a choreographer and a couple of his associates, Danny Dwayne Wells II. We brought him in, and he did a wonderful job of taking this show that is so active and, dare I say, athletic, and did a great job of pushing all of us to sort of, I think we all found our boundary and found where we can handle, which is great. That's what we want in not only an educational setting, but also in this sort of like vibe. It's just fun. And you want to feel like you're constantly working so that by the time you do get to opening night, it's still a challenge, but it's totally attainable. And I think Dee Dee did a great job of doing that and talking with Martin and myself about what is the overall vision for it physically. So it's Dee Dee, Stephen, and Joshua who come in and do that. We love that trio. They also do work for Bradford and do some of their musicals. Dee Dee just choreographed Trevor back in, I think that was January or February,
It was January, yep.
And he just did Beehive, that I know is opening, I think, this weekend as well, or very soon. And Dee Dee and I actually knew each other from New York, being in the same audition rooms, but never knew each other. And then a friend of mine, I was on music director on a national tour who I had replaced. And then he found out I moved to Kenosha to take this job. And he's like, wait, my friend's in Chicago. And then Dee Dee and I found out we actually had like known each other for years, but never knew each other. Because in New York City, the world is literally so small, and you're in the same audition rooms with the same people all the time. Which is so funny that like we didn't know each other, and then all of a sudden I'm like, hi, will you come do choreo for me?
Yeah.
And so I'm very thankful to have him on board. board, and also very thankful to have our students on board for this. So Sierra Clark is our costume designer, and she really did a lot of research on this, like, turn of the century, what is this 2001 vibe, which is a very specific time in fashion culture. It's a lot of low-rise jeans. It's a lot of midriffs. It's a lot of, I always think of the sunglasses that, like, ombre'd to clear. So they were, like, pink that ombre'd down to nothing. Like, it's just so random. There's butterfly clips in hair. Mm-hmm. There is all of these, like, wonderful things. And Sierra really took time, along with our professor Kim, to really do the research on this. And it really looks like you're stepping back in time. Like,
wow.
Elle's got these pink shoes that are, like, pink foam shoes, and it fully takes me back to when I was in high school and seeing the girls in my class walk around with those shoes. And I'm like, this is amazing that she even found those.
Wow.
From the costume, and then Gabby Tift, who did our lighting and projection, she's really created this world that we live in where the whole set, and Martin also designed our set. And between that projection and lights, you sort of live in this house the whole time, and then the house changes its sort of identity all the way through. And she's done a great job of using lighting to really tell that side of the story and to add excitement to the choreo, which is always my favorite thing in any production. I love to see how a lighting designer not only understands music but also understands choreography, and Gabby does a brilliant job of that. And she's also booked and blessed moving on. She's got a job in sound or lighting moving forward.
I think it's lighting.
Is it lighting? Yeah.
Positive.
Me either. Positive. Hey, it's in the show.
Yes.
So, you know, it's just such great work that our students are doing. We've got an entire student-led stage management team that is crushing it every night. It is a thankless job, and it is hard. And when you have a 23-person musical, and then you've got costume crew and stage crew that is nearly 20 people, it's a big undertaking. And I will say all the students are stepping up to the plate and doing a great job of this. And that is, again, the thing I love about education and educational theater is we sort of get to turn things over to the humans and then watch them do it. And sometimes they'll fail and we have to, like, keep helping them through. For example, I have two grad students who are running the soundboard. And they've never run a soundboard before in their lives, but they're literally going to walk out of here knowing how to run a soundboard and not be afraid of it.
Right.
And I wish I had that experience, but this is, again, you know, educational theater, and it's so great. So just the fact that, you know, Martin and I get to be at the helm of this ship that is really led by the students is truly an honor for me. And it's the thing I love most about teaching is watching the growth from these humans and then knowing that they're going to leave here as better people and also have a fun time on stage. That's
terrific.
The whole point.
Can't ask for more than that. Real quick from each of you, Alexan, a favorite song from the show.
Ooh. I love Bend and Snap. It's so fun.
And what's it about?
So basically, it was a move invented by the UCLA cheerleaders to break the will of the opposing team. Basically, where you bend down to the floor and then you snap back up to sort of entice whoever you want.
All right. That sounds like it's worth seeing and hearing. How about you, Caitlin?
Oh, my gosh. Well, my favorite song in the show is Chip on My Shoulder, which is like, it's just a banger. But my favorite song to sing has to say Legally Blonde Remix. It's like the big celebration of the show. Mm. It's the big Vivian turning point. So, like, you know, I always have a good time with that. And then, at the end, I'm like screaming my little head off and we're all like, woo, and we're so excited.
Melting for Jesus.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah. And Nikki?
My favorite song is definitely Take It Like a Man. Mm-hmm. It's in the second act. It's the one where Elle gives Emmett a makeover and really returns the favor that he did for her, and she shows him what he can be and pushes him to be his best self too.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sounds cool. Legally Blonde is performed this weekend and the following weekend at Carthage College in the Wartburg Auditorium. So it's tomorrow night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon, right? And then the following weekend, I think it's Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. So the evenings are always 7:30. The Sunday afternoon is 3?
Yeah.
Okay. And I know you have a daytime performance you're doing for high school students as well. If people want tickets, what do they do?
Head to www.carthage.com. carthage.edu/tickets, and you can get them there.
Very good. Matt Hoagland is director of musical theater at Carthage, and with him, three students in the cast for Legally Blonde, Alexan Cervantes, Caitlin Preuss, and Nikki Caldwell. Thank you all four of you during this busy week for being part of the morning show today. This was really, really fun, and best wishes with all of your performance of this wonderful show, Legally Blonde, for this weekend and the following. Best wishes to all of you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
It's 8:51. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. To finish out today from The Morning Show Archives, a conversation I was privileged to record some years ago with the co-founder of Apple, Steve Wozniak. For a precious few minutes, I have the pleasure and honor of speaking with Steve Wozniak, who helped reshape the world by reshaping the computers that you and I now take for granted. But it was really Steve Wozniak more than anybody who came up with the concept that became the personal computers first produced by Apple and then, of course, by other countries around the world. He has a wonderful new memoir called I Was, Computer Geek to Cult Icon, How I Invented the Personal Computer, Co-Founded Apple, and Had Fun Doing It, published by W.W. Norton & Company. And Steve Wozniak, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, glad to be here.
I've enjoyed this book. I have to ask you something about the way it's written. You have a co-conspirator in the writing of the book, but I have to say that this book sounds so spontaneous. It does not sound particularly well scrubbed, like an editor has really taken to it and rubbed all the rough edges away. It sounds just like you talk.
Yes, I have no book experience, but Gina said we should get an agent. We got an agent. He sold the book. In each of the book publishers that bought it, they contacted me on the phone, and they said, we want to do this book, but we want it in Steve's voice. So what I did was I spoke into a tape recorder. Gina, you know, edited it together. Then we went through it paragraph by paragraph to make sure that it sounded the way I talk naturally in the world, for genuineness. I love genuine.
Well, that's certainly what this book is. I have really enjoyed it so thoroughly. One of the things that you do in your book is that you really give credit where credit is due in terms of how you came to have this marvelous genius for inventing new things. And we see that credit being given to a number of different people, but in particular, some of the teachers who really nurtured these promising gifts you had as a young person.
Very lucky. Actually, one teacher made me so inspired that I really believed in wanted to be a teacher like her someday, teaching fifth grade, which I did in my life. It's in the book. I also had another teacher in electronics who found a way to get me educated in a company outside of school where they had computers that we didn't have, something he felt that I could learn about.
Something that was interesting, too, about computers, one of the first things when you saw them, even back in the days when they were huge and not accessible to regular people, you said computers were actually kind of simple the closer you looked at them. And this is part of the insight which helped you develop them for all of us to use.
That's the funny thing. Computers work on zeros and ones. I mean, we've already learned how to add digits 0 through 9. So zeros and ones, you learn how to add them, and you say, well, God, anybody can learn this. You don't need calculus. You don't need trigonometry. You don't need differential equations.
One of the things that was interesting about your personality, maybe to this day, is that you were quite a shy person, and you said that your clever designs were in some ways a more comfortable way for you to communicate with others, to socialize with others through the designs you made.
It was a huge advantage to me that I had a lot of very unusual techniques. Actually doing anything unusual, different than other people did, would get a little bit of attention that I had no way to get on my own being so shy.
One of the greatest things about your story is that you visited a group called the Homebrew Computer Club back in 1975, a bunch of people like you who are interested in computers, but you kind of misunderstood what that group was about. And if you hadn't had that misunderstanding, you probably never would have gone to that first meeting. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
I was scared of things that I didn't know about, and I didn't know about these new chips called microprocessors that had evolved. I had sort of missed out on that, so I would not have gone to a meeting dealing with microprocessors. But a friend, just by coincidence, has said, it's a meeting for people with video terminals. I had just designed one. So I thought, God, I'll show off my design. I'll pass it out. I'll be a big star in this new club. So I went, and what I discovered was, oh, my gosh, I now know a formula for building this computer I wanted my whole life.
Well, and because you had been playing around with televisions and with things like that old game Pong and some other things, you were actually building up a technical know-how, which was really going to come in handy then when you created this new idea of a computer with a screen.
Yeah, well, I had the technical know-how from very early years, actually going back to elementary school, a very good computer know-how, and I got so good at designing things. But more than that, I like to do, when I came home from Hewlett-Packard working on calculators, I liked to do other interesting electronic things of the day, like hotel movie systems. Pong games started up, the first video games. And so I actually designed my own versions. The only way I could ever get something was to build it myself because I couldn't afford to buy the real thing. And then I built a terminal that would talk to what was called the ARPANET, which is the early forerunner of today's Internet, started by the U.S. military, by DARPA. It was called the ARPANET. And I discovered it, and I had to build a machine that could type to computers far away on this ARPANET just so I could, I don't know, feel proud that I had one. And so all these little things that I did all wound up converging on the Apple II computer eventually.
One of the most extraordinary things about what you developed and began marketing, of course, with Steve Jobs and this new company called Apple, is that very early on in this process, you had no copyrights or patents on any of these things that you were designing and developing, and you would show it to everybody. There was this marvelous openness about the way you were doing this.
To me, the club was sharing and helping others get to a better place in life, and I was going to help other people build their own computer themselves. You can have your own. Here's the design. Copy mine. Steve Jobs came along later and said, let's start a company to sell a piece of it called a PC board for $40. And eventually, the local store talked us into selling whole computers. So we didn't really just go out gung-ho and say, let's start a computer company. And after the computer was designed and I was giving it out for free, we didn't say, let's start a computer company. Step by step, it's just that the demand was there.
A quick question about Apple. When it started, you said it was an engineering-centric model of a company. It became more of a marketing-driven company. That was something you were a little less comfortable with. Explain what that difference is.
Well, in Hewlett-Packard, where I worked, we built the products that engineers use to design other things. We built their oscilloscopes. We built their power supplies. We built their signal generators. We built their calculators, their engineering calculators. So we understood the market, and we were in control of deciding what products should come next. We had very good minds in that regard. And the Apple II, the Apple I and II computers, I designed them all alone in my own room just for myself. And so it was easy to, so I was totally driven by engineering, what chips were available. When we started the company with real money, we brought in this marketing guy, and he said, no, the success is going to be really a marketing success. We have to be a marketing-driven company, understand needs of the users.
Interesting.
So Apple was run differently than Hewlett-Packard. But we weren't making products precisely for engineers. We were making them for everyday average people.
And for your own
engineer is not a good judge of that.
Right. But you were designing things for your own enjoyment, and the rest is history. The book is I Was, the author Steve Wozniak. Steve Wozniak, congratulations on a superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we preview a couple of other things that are coming up this weekend. We'll preview the opera workshop at Carthage College with Katie Ann Nelson, a very gifted senior who is about to perform in her final opera workshop at Carthage, portraying the role of Constanze Mozart, the widow of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.